A new prime minister has been elected in Israel. What impact will he have on the peace process? And an American cardinal has been asked to preach the Lenten papal retreat. We'll tell you which one. And in our interview segment, 3 years after the Pope's historic visit to Cuba, what is life like on the island nation? And what of the Catholic Church there? It's all ahead on The World Over Live.
From our EWTN studios, Raymond Arroyo.
Welcome to The World Over Live. In a moment, our look at Cuba 3 years after the papal visit. But first, news from the world over this week. Right-wing Likud party leader Ariel Sharon became the new prime minister of Israel this week. He trounced Ehud Barak in a landslide election. Mr. Barak conceded defeat less than 2 hours after exit polls showed him losing by 19 percentage points. Officials at the Latin Rite Patriarchate of Jerusalem were surprised by the overwhelming margin of victory, but are cautiously hopeful that Sharon will commit to the peace process.
The government of Israel will act to restore the security and stability we need. Any agreement will be based on the security needs of all the peoples in our region and must protect the vital and historical interests of the State of Israel, including a united Jerusalem as our eternal capital.
But despite the size of Mr. Sharon's mandate, forming a stable government may not be an easy task. He has 45 days to form a coalition with the Labor Party, something Barak was unable to do. Meanwhile, tensions continue in the region. Two huge car bombs shook an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in West Jerusalem just a day after Sharon's victory. The prime minister has suspended talks until the violence ends. In the United States, the president urged restraint from both Palestinians and Israelis and pronounced the Clinton peace plan for the region no longer relevant. And the European Union may offset U.S. cuts in overseas abortion funding. Several nations are poised to fill the financial gap left by President Bush's decision to halt U.S. payments to international abortion organizations. Dutch Minister of Foreign Aid Evelyn Herfkens is suggesting that any budget shortfalls due to the American position should be compensated for by a, quote, quick and strong European response. The matter is due to be discussed this week in London. And in the United States, a new bill being introduced in the Senate seeks to restrict access to the abortion pill, RU486. The bill introduced by Senator Tim Hutchison of Arkansas would allow only those doctors legally qualified to perform abortions to prescribe the drug. Backers of the measure say that the restrictions are less severe than those in Europe, where the drug is currently available. Abortion rights advocates are critical of the bill. They say its real purpose is to limit access to the abortion pill. And in Rome, more papal travels are in the works. It was announced this week that John Paul II will visit Damascus, Syria on May 5th and then proceed to the tiny island of Malta on May 8th. Both these visits are part of the Holy Father's personal pilgrimage in the footsteps of St. Paul. According to Vatican officials, the trip is intended to bring reconciliation and peace among Christians. The Pope still intends to travel to Ukraine in June, despite the objections of the Russian Orthodox Church, and a visit to Armenia is set for September. Also in Rome, Cardinal Francis George of Chicago is set to conduct the Pope's annual Lenten retreat. The retreat will be held March 4th through 10th in the Pope's private chapel. Cardinal George is expected to take a more scholarly approach to the year's presentation. And the church continues to grow in the United States. According to the 2001 Catholic Almanac, just out this week, the United States has the third largest Catholic population in the world. There are 62.4 million Roman Catholics in the U.S. The only countries with more are Brazil at 139 million and Mexico at 118 million. Of the states, only Rhode Island has a Catholic majority. They make up 64.3% of the population. Catholics predominate in California, New York, and Texas, which together make up just over one-third of the U.S. total. And in Havana this week, a Cuban Catholic dissident group announced the formation of an independent Christian library. The New Jerusalem Library will operate out of the home of its founder, Isabel del Pinto. She will be providing access to various underground Catholic magazines and newsletters published in the communist country. The library will also make available encyclopedias and books on Christian history to give the people much-needed religious information. Since 1998, these independent libraries have been flourishing in several Cuban cities. Because they operate out of homes, the police have found it difficult to shut them down. More on Cuba after the break. But first, here is an arts and culture segment on an important and beautiful cathedral in the Dominican Republic. Take a look. More than 500 years ago, a cross was planted in the soil and in the soul of the Dominican Republic. Alejandro Geraldini, the first bishop of the Americas, erected this cross of the evangelization in 1514. In this spot, he sowed the seed from which the first Catholic cathedral would soon grow. Completed in 1541 after a 20-year construction, the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Incarnation is infused with the artistic influences of the period. Through its Gothic doors, one encounters a Baroque altarpiece beautifully illuminated by rose and stained glass windows. The Blessed Sacrament Chapel reinforces the Baroque influence with its own impressively built altar. Standing confidently in the center and supporting a tabernacle adorned in fine silver, the altar expresses the centrality of the Eucharist in the lives of the Dominican faithful. These styles and materials unite in one transcendent hymn of praise, all springing from a simple cross. Stay with us when we return. What is the state of the Catholic Church in Cuba in the wake of the 1998 papal visit? The World Over Live continues in a moment.
Can scientific research be conducted in a morally responsible way? Get the latest in the debate over bioethics next week on The World Over Live on EWTN.
One night my husband had a dream, and Elizabeth Ann Seton, who we didn't even know, appeared to him and said, "Come to the church."
Each week on The Journey Home, Marcus Grody and his guests share their personal experiences in coming back to the church. The Journey Home. See it live here on EWTN.
She remains a land of many saints, though her faith has been tried by war and tyrants. France has been called the eldest daughter of the church. Join us for an all-new two-part special presentation here on the Global Catholic Network, EWTN.
Once again, Raymond Arroyo.
Welcome back to The World Over Live. Much excitement surrounded the Pope's pastoral visit to Cuba in 1998. The eyes of the world looked to the small island nation, wondering what would happen in the wake of that visit. But like so many events, once the cameras were packed away and the papal plane lifted off the tarmac, attention shifted to other affairs. For those on the island, life goes on, for better or worse. So does the struggling faith. Here's a reminder of what happened in the winter of 1998.
The Holy Father came to plant seeds of faith in both the young and old. His words reflected a deep desire to unite the island nation from decades of political and religious unrest. The Pope challenged the youth in Cuba to step forward and lead the Church's efforts to spread the message of Christ.
To help you, I am leaving a written message with the hope that it will arrive to all the young people of Cuba, the future of the church and country, a future that begins in the present.
Cubans realize that instilling the Catholic faith in their youth will be more challenging now than ever before.
We have seen a certain escapism,
on the part of the adolescents from the values
of the church in Cuba. We are pleased to be joined by my guest, Dr. Juan Clark. He is a sociologist at the Miami-Dade Community College and the author of the book Religious Repression in Cuba. Also at the table is Father Francisco Santana, the associate director of the Our Lady of Charity Shrine in Miami and host of a regular talk show on Radio Martí. Gentlemen, I thank you both for being here. I'd like to start with Dr. Clark. Tell me, what is the environment in Cuba right now? What is the relationship between the Castro regime and the people there in Cuba?
Well, Cuba is still a totalitarian system in which the government attempts to control practically every dimension of social life. The economy is under the tight control of the government. Education is under the absolute control of the government. Medical care is under the absolute control of the government. In other words, there are very few things that are not really under the tight fist of the government in Cuba today. Castro had to open a little bit as a result of the economic crisis, but once he realized that he was able to surpass that crisis, is beginning to close again. So it is a situation in which a lot of people believe that really there is no hope, that that situation is not going to change and substantially improve. And that's why you see people leaving in the most unbelievable ways, in inner tube rafts. And just recently we saw this case of this two young men that tried to leave in the inner wheel of an airliner and died in the effort trying to get to London. So that tells you a little bit about what is going on. Unfortunately, for the Cuban people, they see a system that doesn't seem to be weakened by the crisis that Castro has had since the Soviet Union suspended its subsidy that, according to experts, was superior to what the U.S. gave to Europe during the Plan Marshall after Second World War. So in connection with religion, you can say that, yes, religion has been repressed and continues to be repressed. But like a religious authority told me after the Pope's visit, they said, well, it keeps being an iron fist on velvet gloves with a little bit more of velvet. But more recently, it seems that the iron fist seems to be becoming more and more evident.
Yeah, I want to talk a bit about that in a moment. Father Santana, why are people willing to risk their lives in this fashion? I mean, we have people who almost know they face certain death when they get into those dark waters, and yet they do it. Why are they doing it?
Out of an absolute sense of desperation, a sense of frustration, a sense of being in a country in which there is no future. Somebody that lives in Cuba told me once that the people there feel like being on an airplane that have been hijacked by a madman with a grenade on his hand. That madman have a name, Fidel Castro. And they were telling me the problem is who takes that grenade away from his hands. Because, and the church is in the same plane. It's a very difficult situation. And I am so hurt when I talk to people of goodwill that tell me things like, for example, oh, well, now everything is fine in Cuba, the Pope went there, we watch it on television, now the church has a lot of freedom. Somebody, even this morning, was telling me that I feel so hurt because I know what's happening. I talk to bishops that come from Cuba and visit our train.
I want to refresh the memories of our viewers, and I want to show this bit. This is the Pope's message on the day he arrived in Cuba, a truly historic moment. Take a look at this, and then we'll discuss the fallout of what happened subsequently. Take a look.
I well know how much you have looked forward to the moment of my visit, and you know how much I have desired it. Therefore, my best wishes are joined in the prayer that this land may offer to everyone a climate of freedom, mutual trust, social justice, and lasting peace. May Cuba, with all its magnificent potential, open itself up to the world, and may the world open itself to Cuba, so that this people, which is working to make progress and which longs for concord and peace, may look to the future with hope.
So, gentlemen, did Cuba open itself to the world? Did the world open itself to Cuba? I'll start with you, Dr. Clark.
Well, the world tried to open itself to Cuba, but Cuba did not seem to be willing to hear the world and open itself to the world, and more important than that, to open itself to the Cuban people.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean how Cubans are discriminated by that government. Cubans, for instance, cannot have businesses of their own. Cubans cannot buy a car. Cubans are like indentured servants of that government. And that's one of the reasons for the desperation that Father Santana was talking about. In the countryside, is an absolute control that is superior to what existed in the Soviet Union and in China. So definitely it has not opened to the Cuban people itself. Mm-hmm. It's as tight as it can be, and well, the people are tired of that kind of situation and looking to alternatives. Unfortunately, the alternative is fleeing. Like they say to me more than one occasion, I come not fleeing, not pursuing the American dream, but fleeing the Cuban totalitarian nightmare.
Mm. Father Santana, I want to move on to this. When we look at this papal visit, paint for me a picture, if you will, of the expectation and the spirit of the Cuban people prior to the Pope's visit. What were their expectations of this visit? What did they hope would happen?
Prior to the visit, certainly the expectations of the church in Cuba, the bishops, the priests, and the people were great. They thought that the Pope's visit to Cuba somehow was going to mark a point to begin a process of transition, mm-hmm. peaceful transition, a process of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, during those days were so special, so incredible, not only for the people in Cuba, but also for the people in Miami. It was a miracle. There are no words to describe what mm-hmm. we lived those 5 days. But after the 5 days were over, Castro had the best opportunity in his life to really begin a process of peaceful transition. And I am talking not about weeks, I am talking about a year, 3 years, 5 years, mm-hmm. but at least a sense of future, some kind of sense of goodwill. Mm-hmm. The Pope mm-hmm. gave his heart, he gave his, the church in Cuba have the best of wills, but we are ourselves in a situation in which there is a government that have a tyrant, that's Fidel Castro, that doesn't want any changes in Cuba. Mm-hmm. So if you ask me, the expectations were very high. Mm-hmm. 3 years after the visit, nothing has changed from the point of view of the regime that's mm-hmm. still as totalitarian, mm-hmm. as repressive as ever. Nothing has changed as a matter of fact. Things are getting worse in the relations between church and state.
I want to pick up on that. How are they getting worse? Let's talk for a moment about public displays of faith, public processions, outdoor practice of worship. Following the visit, we saw Christmas reinstated for the first time in what?
1969.
Okay, well, 30 years.
Yeah.
Why then, or what has happened subsequently? How did it contract?
Well, Castro apparently, as a result of the great pressure from the Vatican, and it's very interesting to look at what happened, they had planted, the Pope did not escape the direct repression of the regime, and they had planted a listening device in his room, which was discovered by the Vatican security people, and apparently one condition that they put was that they allow Christmas in 1997, and apparently the pressure kept on, and it was finally agreed that they will restore this as a holiday for the Cuban people. Uh-huh. But that is, you might say, cosmetics, because uh-huh. deep inside, for instance, we know how recently people that have degrees like medicine, engineering, etc., and they enter the seminary, they lose completely those degrees. Right. What's the reason for that?
Oh, that would be my question to you. What is the reason? What is it, a fear of what was witnessed during that time? What was seen during that papal visit that has caused this repression, Father?
Castro doesn't want the church in Cuba to have and to hold the power that the church did show when the papal visit. We were able in Cuba to move millions of people, and they did this on a voluntary basis, contrary to the ways in which the government have their own political demonstrations. Castro doesn't want the church to play a role in Cuban history. He doesn't see the need of the church in a Cuban society. He still have the same totalitarian, atheistic, I will say diabolic, that's the word. He doesn't have changed a bit. And I truly believe that even prior to the visit, he never had in mind, never even crossed through his mind, the possibility of giving a chance to goodwill and follow what the Pope was saying. For him, it was just a political game in which he thinks that he has won. But in reality, I don't think that's true.
If you have a question, give us a call at 205-271-2980 or 1-800-221-9460 or email us at theworldover@ewtn.com. We'll take all your calls and questions in just a moment. I want to pick up on what you were just saying. If that is the case, why did he allow the church to come in? Why did he allow the Pope? Was it simply to draw international attention to himself?
A political game.
I think it was a political game aimed at trying to lift the economic embargo. He knows that the church has been opposed to the economic embargo. But when you analyze the words of the Pope, the economic embargo did not come up as a top priority for the Pope. The Pope preached about the importance of Christ, of course,
right.
The importance of freedom, the importance of the family, the importance of being involved in the process precisely of developing that country. Castro is tremendously afraid, I think, of the potential of the church, of the fact that the church could be a rallying point that could be dangerous for the future of that totalitarian system.
Give me, in our remaining minutes, a snapshot of the repression tactics being used now in the church. What is life like for the church in Cuba?
At the present, remains very difficult, very hard. For example, nowadays we see lots of children that come to catechism classes on Sundays. Well, at the same time at the school, they have like special events, and if the child doesn't attend to those events, then he is punished at school, so he cannot go to catechism classes. Just an example.
Right.
And also, they are always giving the church the idea by the presence, by the activities that they have in front of the churches, like on Sundays, at the times people go to Mass. They are trying to intimidate people. Castro is trying to create like a cultural revolution. He is like coming back to ideology, and he sees Christianity as a great threat to that purpose.
Dr. Clark, any examples you can
cite? Yes. For instance, the discrimination that the Christian lay person suffers at the hands of the government, both at the educational, at the occupational level, that is pervasive. There are careers that are prohibited for those that happen to be, for instance, journalism is one of those, that has a potential to influence the people. Those are completely closed for the lay persons. Within the occupational system, there is that systematic discrimination again, where you are going to be, for sure, for the rest of your life, a second or third class citizen. Castro once said, we're going to make apostates, not martyrs. And that's what he had been doing, trying to make the life difficult. Imagine this person that was a doctor, entered the seminary. You know, now he cannot practice as a doctor. What is he accomplishing with that? Simply harassing, making the life more difficult. We know how this is happening.
Tell me about the church infrastructure. What's happening there? The actual physical buildings and the churches.
Many of the buildings, especially in the interior of the country, the churches, the roofs have been collapsing because of lack of repair. And we know how they have been subjected to vandalism, again, in a way that you cannot say, oh, is it the state security? No, it's the people that do that. They always do it in that subtle way in which you cannot claim that it's the government that is doing it. Making the life more difficult to the church in, for instance, buying materials. The church cannot go and buy a car for a priest to go and visit the different parishes and so forth. Mm-hmm. They cannot import priests that want to go to Cuba to work in Cuba. Mm. It's a constant process of harassment at the lay level and at the priest and bishop level.
Very good. We will leave it there for a moment. When we return, we'll discuss the interaction between the Vatican and the Castro government, and what effect did the Elian Gonzalez case have on and off the island. And we'll take your questions when The World Over Live continues.
This week on The Abundant Life, when we will be talking about Lives of the Saints for Every Day. Our guest is Bert Gezi, and I know that you will enjoy this wonderful discussion.
Because of their humanness, they show us how we human beings, men and women, can be like them if we'll simply respond faithfully to God's grace.
Join us for The Abundant Life only on the Global Catholic Network, EWTN.
In the raging fire of war and hatred, a great saint is forged.
The methodical outbreak of National Socialist race hatred on the nights of November 8th and 9th, 1938, abruptly destroyed the citizenship of the Jews and exposed them to open and brutal persecution. I was afraid of something like that and tried in vain to warn against it.
Edith Stein, Stations of an Extraordinary Life, only on EWTN.
St. John in the fourth gospel begins by saying that the law came through Moses, grace and truth through Jesus Christ.
Father George Rutler examines deeper aspects of our faith, grace and truth, an all-new original series coming next month to EWTN.
Campsite. Jawsite. Anthracite. With so many sites to choose from, it's good to know there's one site you can always count on. The website at EWTN.com, that is. Everything you need to know about EWTN is just a click away. Find answers to your questions about the faith. Get news headlines and check out our online library. Just point your browser to www.EWTN.com. Visit today.
Back to The World Over Live. We are discussing the situation in Cuba 3 years after the papal visit. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Juan Clark, author of the book Religious Discrimination or Repression, rather, in Cuba. And next to him is Father Francisco Santana, an associate director of the Shrine of Our Lady of Charity in Miami. I want to go to the phone now, where we are joined by Father Raul Comesaña. He is a consultant to the State Department on Cuban affairs and is a parish priest in Newark. Father Comesañas, thank you for joining us. Give us your impressions of Fidel Castro's psychology. We've seen dictators come and go in South and Central America. How does this man hold on?
Well, first of all, I think that we have short memories, especially here in the West, because we forget that Castro studied very correctly, so Stalinism and European Marxism, and he definitely is applying the Stalinist tactics in his situation in Cuba, especially with regards to the church. And one of the ways that he has done it is that he will give a little bit, and then he will move back and take more. And he will entertain, you know, the world with different, let's say, activities and different, so that he can grab the news media and the headlines, and then he will utilize it so that the world does not zero in on the real problems and the real situations, or even the people at home, the real problems that they're suffering from.
Uh-huh.
It's to entertain them, you know.
Father, I'm going to interrupt you just a second. I want to bring the panel in on this. Gentlemen, your impressions of the interaction between the Pope and Fidel Castro. During the visit, many Western eyes, even mine, saw what appeared to be a conversion, certainly an appreciation or deep respect for the Pope. What did you see during that visit?
Well, I see here the personality of Castro that has this charisma and has this tremendous histrionic power. He's able to fake whatever he wants, and he has the reputation of causing tremendous impression on the people that he talked to. And I understand that some of the Vatican officials were very impressed by the way Castro looked at the Pope. To me, that was simply nonsense. He was trying to use the Pope. He was trying to manipulate the Pope. But that's it. No more than that.
Mm-hmm. Father, your impressions. Surely, are we to believe absolutely nothing was going on?
Well, Castro is the great deceiver. You know, he was all the time playing politics. To me, the Pope was talking to him as a priest talks to someone that needs help. And I am certain that the Pope did his best to try to get to the heart, to try to produce this conversion that you are mm-hmm. talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I pray every day for Castro's conversion, because that will be a great blessing to the Cuban nation and to the Cuban people, but I don't say it.
Father Comesañas, how does Fidel Castro look upon the Catholic Church today? I mean, obviously the Church is in a difficult position. It can't do anything too rash because it will be withdrawn and its powers curtailed. Why does he deal, or does he consider her at all?
I think that you have to understand his economic situation and his problems in trying to feed his state apparatus of control. You know, he needs to raise a certain amount of revenue to support the repressive state officials that he has, the secret police and all of those that side around him, because he knows that once they are not backed economically and they don't have the means to survive themselves, they will turn on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he needs that. But at the same time, you have to, you know, look at the church-state relationships also in line with the whole international political situation and the pressure that he would get from abroad if he went, let's say, to the point of closing everything down and going forward with more massive repressions, which have never been ruled out. In other words, given his situation, if he got into a situation of where open resistance and rebellion, you know, would occur, the church's position would become even more precarious.
Right.
And that I think everybody's aware of, and I think that's what worries us, because mm-hmm. I think the Holy Father, when he went there, in trying to deal with him, was looking not at Fidel Castro, but was looking at...
We seem to have lost Father Gomez. I don't hear him any longer. So we're going to come back to studio. We'll try to reestablish contact. I want to pick up on a point he was making there, though. Do you see the church as positioning itself for the time when Fidel Castro would be moving aside?
The church is doing right now, in this situation that is very difficult, very hard,
mm-hmm.
Is doing and is trying to do the best
mm-hmm.
it can.
Mm-hmm.
The church is trying to be the church. That's what the Pope said when he went to
mm-hmm.
Cuba. But to be the church is to have to be able to have freedom to use like programs like this one.
Mm-hmm.
This is not allowed
mm-hmm.
in Cuba, to be able to educate the children.
Mm-hmm.
All this have been denied to the church. But
right.
The church is there, it's firm. It has kept herself united. And this is very important because, for example, in Nicaragua, we saw when the Sandinistas were there, mm-hmm. how they were able to create like a communist church, a national mm-hmm. popular church.
Is there a threat of that happening in Cuba?
They tried to do that at the very beginning through different efforts, including bishops, but it failed. Mm-hmm. Failed completely. And I think that's one of the great achievements of the Cuban Catholic Church.
Tell me this. Well, when we see the church being suppressed, we see it in China, we see it in various parts of the world, in Africa. When the church is suppressed, it seems to get stronger. What is the case in Cuba? Is the church getting stronger under this repression?
It is, in my opinion. For example, in many ways, at the seminary level, they have there more seminarians than we do in the Archdiocese of Havana. Mm-hmm. They have more than 100 seminarians now in Havana. We see also how lay people are committed, how they, in the midst of all these repressive methods used by the government, mm-hmm. the church is there. They are trying to, for example, at the parish levels, at the diocesan level, they publish different booklets or different bulletins.
Right.
And, of course, this is done on a very humble way, but they do it. One of the main things that also, to me, is a great blessing after the Pope's visit, now they are creating like these prayer houses. And they are doing this without asking permission to the government.
Uh-huh.
So they have taken seriously the words of the Pope, don't be afraid.
From a sociological perspective, Dr. Clark, what are we seeing here? What is this endemic of?
Well, I wanted to add something to what Father Santana just said. There hasn't been a single church built in Cuba, either Catholic or Protestant, since 1959. So that tells you a little bit about the attitude of the government toward the church in general, mm-hmm. Catholic, Protestant, etc. I think that what is happening now, especially with the young people, is that they have seen the failure of Marxism, Leninism, of communism, and they are looking for something new. And that's why we see now the churches with young people, whereas in the past, especially in the 60s, we only saw the old people, mm-hmm. those who didn't have anything to lose,
right?
And now we're seeing young people eager to learn about the church, learn about Christianity. And we see it as signs of progress for the church, the amount of baptisms, the amount of Catholic marriages that are being performed, and increasing vocations. I understand that those have increased tremendously mm-hmm. in Cuba. I see the church as renewing itself, and I hope that the church can be at the level, you might say, that is demanded from it in terms of exercising leadership mm-hmm. in this crucial moment.
You mentioned young people. I want to talk about a particular young person, Elian Gonzalez. We heard much of him last year, culminating in that, in the going into the family home there and taking him Holy Week of last year. Father Santana, you spent an enormous amount of time with the family. You went to his uncle's home several times. We see pictures there of the family. Tell me your impressions of what happened there and what position this put the church in. What was the church's position on Elian Gonzalez?
Those days were very hard for us because we have the same case, Elian Gonzalez, but two different realities, Cuba and we here living in Miami. Mm-hmm. For example, in Cuba, for the church, it's extremely important to defend the rights of the parents mm-hmm. to educate their children mm-hmm. because the problem that they have there is that the state takes those rights away from the parents.
Right.
So from the very beginning, the cardinal, the bishops there said, well, the father is here in Cuba, mm-hmm. the father wants the child to come back, the father and the child should be reunited.
Right.
And of course they were right. And like, we can understand that position in the context in which they have to live. But on the other hand, for us Cubans, Elian became like a symbol of all our sufferings. Mm-hmm. He became like a symbol of the exile community.
He was personal. They personalized him. They saw themselves in him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And because of this, we knew and we know by experience that the idea to send this child back to Cuba, it's like the same idea just to put an example, in the times of Hitler in Germany, you know, this is like a mother that escapes a concentration camp okay. with a child, the father stays at the concentration camp, the mother dies, the father demands the right to be with his child because he is told by the people in command that that's what he had to do. Mm-hmm. And for us it was very clear. It was sending a child back to the prison camp. Mm-hmm. And we knew and we know by experience that the father was not really expressing his own feelings of his own desires. Of
you
course,
spoke to him?
I spoke to him twice. Mm-hmm. On the phone. Mm-hmm. I got to know the family really well. Mm-hmm. If it's a nuclear family, an extended family, that's something that here in America was mm-hmm. not understood at all.
Right.
For us here, the importance is a nuclear family. This is like a tribal family, like an extended family. I saw that child in that home, the Gonzalez home in Miami, as a priest, I was there every day. And I saw how, because of the love that they gave him, how soon he was able to get over the trauma of losing his mother on the sea. This child, since the time he was born, the only thing that he used to hear at his house was that part of the family was already in the United States, mm-hmm. and the rest of the family were going to follow. Mm-hmm. So for him to be there, like the Gonzalez family, it was the most natural thing in the world. Mm-hmm. For him, that was home. And he was taken away from that home and not given back to his father, but given back to a communist regime that doesn't even right now allow anybody to get near the shadow to see how he's doing.
Father Comesañas is back with us on the phone. Father, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Very good. I want to pick your brain here for a minute and ask you, the Vatican as well as the local church had to strike a curious balancing act during this entire Elian Gonzalez episode, and this is what I want you to speak to. In Cuba, it had to maintain the rights of the father. However, that stance eroded confidence in Miami and throughout the United States. And we now have a situation where there are non-Catholic groups using that, the church's stance, as justification for people to come out of the Catholic Church. What is the fallout from that sort of balancing act?
Well, there's no doubt that it was placed.
We've lost Father Comesañas again. I'll ask you, gentlemen, to answer that question. What is the result of that balancing act?
It seems to me that in the case of Elian, I think that we have to wait and see what, as Father Santana, I think, was saying before, we haven't seen yet the true Elian in a situation that we can say that he's expressing himself in a true free way. Mm-hmm. So we still have to wait and see what's going to happen in connection mm-hmm. with this situation. To me, he's probably having a horrendous time in Cuba today, remembering, like he must remember because he's 6 years of age, all the things that he saw, the freedom that he had, and all the good things that he saw in this country, starting with freedom. So it remains to be seen what is going to happen, but it is very significant that they haven't shown pictures and haven't allowed the press to get close to Elian.
Just mm-hmm. to give you an idea, you know, about the balancing act.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right now, the church in Cuba is suffering tremendously because the government in Cuba says that the church did not enough in the case of Elian Gonzalez, that the church fell short of what expectations of the government were. When the chancellor of Cuba went to Rome and visited and talked to the Pope, he was amazed and surprised that the Pope did not know anything about the fact that a group of mafia in Miami had kidnapped a child from Cuba and that this child was held. Kidnapped in Miami, and they were incredibly offended by the fact that the Pope was not aware that the Pope did not know anything about that case. Another thing that they also say is that in Cuba they have all these political tribunes in which people were going and talking and saying, and evangelical ministers were there, mm-hmm. and not a single priest went. Not a single bishop, not a single Catholic layman, and Castro's government doesn't forgive that. So the church is suffering right now in Cuba because Castro feels that they did not do enough.
Very good. Now let's go to the Q&A. This is our Q&A segment. I want to go now to Mary, who is on the phone from Minnesota. Go ahead, Mary. You're on the World Over Live.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions.
Okay.
I understand that when Castro was a young man, he had some Catholic education. Is that correct? And also, he's getting to be older, an older man. Is there someone in line to take his place, you know, when he can no longer be the communist leader?
Very good. Thank you, Mary. Dr. Paul.
As a matter of fact, he had all his life a Catholic education, since well, except for the very first years of elementary school. And that's a very sad thing, you know, because through high school he went to a Catholic education. The one in line to substitute him is his brother, Raul, who happens to be the Minister of Defense and the second secretary of the party. Mm-hmm. So that's what is supposed to happen once Castro disappears.
Okay.
The problem with a totalitarian regime, and Castro knows this, and he even told his friend Daniel in Nicaragua, don't open up society. He knows that Gorbachev began with the perestroika in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union fell apart. So Castro is determined not to give the slightest openness to Cuban society. But I am certain that with Castro's death, the revolution will die. No one else will be able to do what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And I am sure that a process of change will come.
Will occur. And I imagine that is the game here for the church, to position itself to fill that power vacuum when he meets his demise.
To be a service for the reconciliation of the Cuban people.
Mm-hmm. Let's go now to an email. This is from John in Potomac Falls, Virginia. He writes, "Dear World Over Live, how would you describe the vitality of the Cuban-American Catholic community in the United States, and how has the Elian Gonzalez controversy affected that community?" John, Potomac Falls, thank you for the email.
Well, I am there in Miami.
That's right. You're in the high holy place at the Shrine of Our Lady of Charity.
And I see we are very united. It did really brought all of us closer together. Mm-hmm. At times there were certain resentments at the beginning because they wanted the Archbishop of Miami to take like a stronger stand. But he did the only thing that he was able to do, to ask all of us to pray for a just solution of the case. Mm-hmm. So it came out really real well.
Very good.
I would say.
I want to go now to Juan, who is on the phone from Maryland. Go ahead, Juan.
Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I wanted to ask your guest if they think that lifting the embargo on food and medicine could be a good way to pressure Castro for more religious freedom.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen?
Well, the lifting of the embargo is a double-edged sword, no question about it. In this sense, we can say that the embargo has not worked in the sense of bringing the government down. On the other hand, we have to say that if the international community would put the necessary pressure, I think Castro will have to actually open in some way, if the international community, like in the case of South Africa, did. I think this will work in the case of Cuba. Castro has indicated that he is not very much indicated really in truly in the lifting of the embargo. Mm-hmm. He said it recently with medicine that was being offered to him, and he simply didn't want it because deep inside he doesn't care about the people. He cares about himself,
right?
And that's what needs to be understood. Castro really doesn't care but for his image and for his position that he will leave once he leaves this world. Mm-hmm. And he knows that that may not be too far away.
Father Santana.
For him, the essence of his life, of his leadership, of his ego, is the fact that he has been an enemy of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. He is going to die if not a miracle occurs. He's mm-hmm. not going to die becoming a friend of the United States. He doesn't right. want the embargo to be lifted. And the way he shows that is that he is not willing to lift the embargo that he has placed himself on the Cuban people. Mm-hmm. That's where the problem is.
Mm-hmm. I want to shift gears now. I want to talk about the future of the Catholic Church in the country. What are the prospects for the Catholic Church in Cuba at this point, in your opinion?
Well, it's there. It's still growing. There is like a vacuum because of the lack of sense of meaning of life. We see the younger generations coming to church. We see the children coming to church. People are looking for answers. People are looking for our Lord Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And the church is doing, I will say, I have such an admiration and such a respect for the bishops, the priests, the cardinal, the lay people there that are doing such a tremendous work preaching the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Dr. Clark, the lasting influence, in your opinion, of that papal visit, what did that trip mean to those loyal, faithful Catholics on the island?
Well, I think that visit implied a tremendous encouragement, a shot in the arm to these people that have been so repressed for so many years.
And some people who never even knew there was such a thing as a Roman Catholic Pope. I mean, many of these people didn't, we have to admit, never realized there was such a person, all the young people.
That's the way it was, you know. And so I think that was a tremendous stimulation, especially for the young people of Cuba. And I think that the Pope has Cuba very much at his heart. He said, after he returned to Rome, that he hoped that Cuba will follow the same pattern as after his visit to Poland. Mm-hmm. And we know that he has pressed the Cuban bishops to exercise a more active role in the process of change. So it is a tremendous challenge, because there's no question that the Catholic Church is the only institution in Cuba that can in some way fill the vacuum that Castro is going to leave, and could be like a beam to guide the Cuban people in the future, moving toward the common good of the people and trying to reconcile and trying to heal the wounds after so many years of discrimination, repression, etc.
You know, I was talking to a Cuban priest just the other day, a Cuban-born priest, and he suggested that early on in the Pope's pontificate, some Cuban bishops were assembled and priests, and they said, you know, Holy Father, we'd love to do more, but we're afraid that our freedoms would be curtailed, the power of the church would be rescinded, we would be put back where we were, we would lose ground. And the Pope pounded on the table and said, the church needs martyrs. Will we see more of that, do you think? Will we see martyrdom there?
Well, there were many martyrs. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that many people were executed in front of a firing squad shouting, long live Christ the King. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so those were martyrs that need to be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And there were many that not only gave their lives, but went to prison for 10, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Father Loredo.
That's, the case of Father Loredo is a good example. Mm-hmm. Okay, 10 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit. Those things need to be known by the Cuban people.
Uh-huh.
Because there are many
crime?
Martyrs.
Tell us very briefly. We only have a minute. Tell us what he was accused of.
He was accused of harboring a person that tried to hijack a Cubana de Aviación airplane, mm-hmm. which was totally false. But he had committed the sin of being very popular with the youth, and that's something that they could not pardon. Mm-hmm.
And to survive in Cuba by itself is martyrdom.
Mm. A white martyrdom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think you have the case of Osvaldo Payá, the top Catholic political opposition
dissident.
Leader, mm-hmm. dissident. Well, he's a martyr in a sense. Mm-hmm. Because he has sacrificed the future of his family, of his kids, that are being threatened now in their personal integrity to remain there. So there you have a martyr right there,
right,
a living martyr.
Well, I thank you both for calling our attention to this
troubled region of the world, and we, of course, join in prayer with you for those brothers and sisters there on the island. Father Santana, Dr. Clark, we thank you for being here. Another communist country, China, continues to repress its people. For some commentary on the situation, here is Steve Mosier in tonight's Insight segment.
The Chinese government, heedless of the suffering the one-child policy has caused for the Chinese people, has now vowed to continue restricting births for another half century. According to a newly released government white paper on population, the new goal of the Beijing government is a population of 1.6 billion by the year 2050. The one-child policy, which limits couples in the city to one child and farmers to two if the first is a girl, will remain in place for the next 50 years. China's communist government claims that China's population must be capped in order to reduce poverty and to lift the standard of living. Blaming the Chinese people for their own poverty is like blaming the victim of a crime for being victimized. The one-child policy has, in many ways, made things in China worse. The elderly are rapidly increasing as a percentage of the population, straining medical resources. Female infanticide, the killing of girl children, continues to run at epidemic levels. Equally seriously, the sex ratio in China is increasingly unbalanced. Demographers now estimate that because of the one-child policy and the age-old Chinese preference for sons, there are now 100 million more men than women in China. This is a number equivalent to the entire male population of the United States between the ages of 14 and 80. Over the next few years, these 100 million young males in China will gradually come of age, and they will realize that because of the shortage of women, they will never be able to find a bride and get married and have children. Growing labor unrest, an increasing number of young, unattached young men, and spreading resentment against government corruption and abuses of human rights may prove to be a very explosive mixture. The only question is whether it will be directed towards Beijing or contained by Beijing and redirected outward. This is Stephen Mosier with the Population Research Institute.
Well, that is all the time we have. Be sure to join us next week for another live edition of The World Over. We'll be talking bioethics with Dr. Pellegrino from Georgetown. If you would like to contact us in the meantime, be sure to drop us an email at worldover@ewtn.com or write us here at the network. Until next week, we will be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, I'm Raymond Arroyo, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.